Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I am, well, I would say pleased, but the truth is I am blasted to have Mary Jo Foley here. She has covered the tech industry for more than a quarter of a century for a variety of publications and websites. She's the author of Microsoft 2.0, How Microsoft Plans to Stay Relevant in the Post-Gates Era. And she has written for ZDNet, eWeek, and Baseline, among other publications. Mary Jo has been following Microsoft for the past 10 years. She was the author of the At the Evil Empire column. I love that. And now is the author of All About Microsoft blog at ZDNet. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jesse.
I'm very, very excited to have you here.
Same here. I'm honored to be on your podcast.
Well, you're very kind. So tell me, we'll go straight to it. Tell me what you're thinking about. You've been to Mix, you've been to TechEd. What are you thinking? What are you seeing?
Well, in terms of Windows Phone 7, I'm very excited about what we're hearing and seeing going forward about Mango. And I'm also going to be going to the Microsoft VIP preview for Windows Phone, which is on May 24th here in New York. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see, because every time I turn around, there's more and more and more things that are supposedly coming in Mango. And I already was kind of a fan of Windows Phone ever since I got a loaner unit back last fall when they were first coming out. And I've been waiting and waiting and waiting for Verizon to introduce their first Windows Phone, which they announced this week. So I guess I'm really thinking, you know, what is all this good features, all the good feature stuff that Microsoft's adding to the phone platform going to be enough to start helping it pick up some momentum?
I have to agree that I'm very excited about the Mango release and what's coming with it. And I think that you're put your finger on the key question. One of the things that I'm encouraged by is some of the organizations that do these kinds of industry projections are projecting that Windows Phone will be in second place or first place in the next couple of years. Do you buy that as a legitimate possibility?
You know, I feel like some of these organizations might be a little overzealous in their prediction about how quickly the Nokia base is going to move to Windows Phone 7. Because all of those predictions that we've seen, you know, Microsoft jumping into second place or even first place sometimes in various predictions, if you look at why they're predicting that, it's all predicated for the most part on Nokia's existing customer set switching over to Windows Phone. And when Microsoft announced the deal with Nokia a couple months ago, I know there was a lot of unrest and fear and doubt among people who have been longtime members of the development community around Nokia, because they're used to being in more of an open source kind of world. And I think they were worried, you know, because Microsoft is always seen as the anti-open source, you know, monopolist, which I think is an unearned reputation, because I think there's a lot of good open source work still happening at Microsoft. But I think it's going to be interesting to see if they can win over the developers and then ultimately the users from the existing Nokia base. If they can, then I think it will grow. The Windows Phone platform will really grow and take off. And if they can't, I think those analysts are going to be revising their predictions downward in the next year or two.
Are there other things that you think Microsoft needs to do in order to really grow the Windows Phone market significantly?
Yeah, this is something a lot of us who are Microsoft watchers debate amongst ourselves on Twitter and our back channels, you know, because a lot of us are very bullish about the platform, but we're very, I don't know what the right word is here, kind of deflated about how poorly it seems to be selling so far. Microsoft hasn't actually given real numbers of how many users have purchased it, but just this week, Gartner came out with their estimates for the first calendar quarter of 2011, and they said there were only about 1.6 million Windows phones sold in the first 3 months of this year worldwide.
What a wild market when you have to say only 1.6 million.
I know. But what concerned me more was how many, according to Gartner at least, how many Windows Mobile 6 phones are still being sold. A lot of people have been saying, who's buying those phones? It's a dead-end platform, and Microsoft has said it's not going to continue the platform. And I think the answer there is their businesses who are buying them, because a lot of businesses are still feeling as though Windows Phone 7 doesn't have all of the kind of functionality and especially the security and manageability protections that they require to actually start deploying phones in the enterprise. So I'd say back to your question, what needs to change? I think one thing that has to change is Microsoft has to bring Windows Phone up to par with Windows Mobile 6 in terms of its enterprise support.
Now, that's really interesting because when you ask most folks about Windows Phone and what it needs to come up to par with, what you usually hear is iPhone and Android. So it's very interesting to take the perspective of we have business users who have a set of expectations based on the existing Mobile 6 platform.
Yeah, it's like Microsoft did kind of a 180, I feel like, when they came out with Windows Phone. They had faced so much criticism in the past for being too business-focused with their phones that they did the exact opposite. And they said, okay, then we're going to just build a consumer phone. And at first, they didn't really want to admit it when you asked them that, you know, isn't this just a consumer phone? The people would say, the executives who you talk to would say, no, it's both. It's for everything. But as time went on and the months started to pass, they admitted it. They said, yeah, we created a consumer phone and the emphasis is gaming and the emphasis is on competing with the iPhone. And we kind of focused it that way and we're going to add the business and enterprise functionality later.
Let me take you in a slightly technical direction, which is how do you see Windows Phone and Silverlight fitting in together and what do you see as trends around that?
This is a topic near and dear to my heart, as you know, since I've been writing a lot about Microsoft's ever-changing strategy around Silverlight. Last year at the PDC, I was the one who talked to Bob Muglia, and he told me our strategy around Silverlight has shifted. And that created quite the brouhaha ever since. I've gotten blamed for a lot of people's failing business pitches. They said, it's my fault that Microsoft's strategy shifted, which is kind of an interesting way to look at it. But what I think they're doing, what I believe they're doing, is they're really focusing on Silverlight being a development platform more and more, and focusing less on it being a cross-platform runtime. And the reason they're doing that is because inside the company, the top brass have decided that HTML5 is Microsoft's cross-platform solution and not Silverlight. So what that means is they're not abandoning Silverlight and they're not killing Silverlight, but they're focusing on Silverlight as a development platform for Windows Phone right alongside XNA and also possibly for applications for Windows 8, according to some of the tips I've gotten, but we haven't heard that directly from Microsoft so far. So I think Silverlight still has a very big future at Microsoft, but it may not be the future that people envisioned just a couple of years ago. Instead of being a cross-platform browser plugin for phones and PCs, I think it's going to become more of a development tool for all different kinds of applications, and especially for line of business applications, which is something people hadn't originally anticipated as recently as just a year or two ago.
You mentioned open source, and you did say that you saw Microsoft as participating in open source. Do you see a trend there overall in terms of Microsoft's policies around open source?
That's an interesting one, because they've kind of gone back and forth over the years on the company stance towards open source. You know, we've evolved a long way from Steve Ballmer calling Linux cancer. That is like not Microsoft's stance anymore, and they've really backed away from that. But it doesn't mean, in my mind, that Microsoft is completely embracing open source. I think they realize that there's value in making sure that people who believe in open source and are using open source tools and technologies don't consider Microsoft the enemy. And they've done a lot of things, say, around Windows Azure and the Microsoft Web Stack to try to get people who are working with things like PHP to see Microsoft's platform as another platform to build for instead of a platform to fight. But at the same time, I also feel there's this undercurrent inside the company still that is not quite sure what to do with open source. And I think that's why you see a lot of Microsoft open source projects being kind of shipped over to the Outer Curve Foundation lately. I think anything that's under an open source license, Microsoft's being very careful about not keeping in-house and moving it to somewhere where they can still have their developers participate, but they won't have any potential legal liabilities and indemnification issues if those come up around the particular products.
And is the focus that you keep on Microsoft targeted at the business interest of Microsoft or more at the developer's interest? That is, should an aspiring developer be reading your column about what's hot and where I should be investing my time, or is it more targeted at folks who are thinking about investing in Microsoft?
It's very interesting. We've done a lot of studies about who reads my blog, and the answer is a little bit of everybody. I have a lot of people who work at Microsoft who read my blog, obviously, because they always tell me it's hard to keep up with everything Microsoft's doing when you work in a particular division. So it's nice to have the horizontal perspective of somebody who's an outsider looking in. But I also have some people who are developers, even though I myself am not a developer, and I can't go super deep into developer topics for that reason. I've got a lot of resellers and systems integrators, and I've got Wall Street analysts too. So when I write an article on my blog, what I try to do is make it not something an everyday consumer probably would want to read, but something that anybody who has any kind of a connection with Microsoft and its products could find some value in. So I almost write to like a least common denominator that I hope all of my readers, whatever level of technicality they have, can get something from what I'm saying. So I do touch on a lot of developer topics. I write a lot about languages and kind of where things are evolving there. I just wrote recently about when C++, which is the next version of C++ coming from Microsoft, for example. But then I also talk about strategy and who's leaving the company and who's being moved into new roles. And I try to make it a lot of different topics where people can come in from different entry points.
And what kind of response do you get from Microsoft insiders and employees?
It's very mixed. And a lot of times it's very tied to which division of Microsoft they work for. There's some divisions at Microsoft that like me more than others.
That's true for me as well.
I think it's a universal truth, right? All of them are talking to me at this point still to varying degrees. Some are more open with me than others. Some will share future plans and talk about, you know, roadmaps and things that are coming up. Others, just because of the nature of their particular business, say like the Windows business, they're much more closed-mouthed and it's hard to get anything out of them. But all in all, I'd say, you know, I go to all the Microsoft shows. I come to campus a lot and do a lot of in-person interviews with people at all different levels and all different parts of the company. And they don't consider me a fangirl, but I don't think they consider me somebody who just gratuitously hates on Microsoft either. I try to be fair. And that I think has earned me the respect that I have to the degree that I have it inside the company.
You mentioned that you occasionally receive tips, and I note on your blog that it solicits gripes, tips, comments, and so forth. How much of the information that you use in making your predictions and in understanding the trends comes from that kind of unsolicited and, for that matter, anonymous kind of tip?
I get a lot of tips. And just because I've been covering Microsoft so long, I think the longevity has helped me kind of earn people's trust that they can tip me. So I get some tips from people who I know who've asked me to keep them anonymous, but I do get a lot of anonymous tips too. And because before I was a blogger, I was a journalist, I kind of have ingrained in me some of the old journalistic principles that I was taught when I was learning the business. And one of those that was really beaten into me when I worked at eWeek was never go out with a story unless you have three independent sources confirming it. So it can't be two people who told each other about it counting as two. They would only count as one. So you have to have three people who don't know each other, haven't talked, who all will confirm the tip and give you pieces of it.
That sounds like the standard that they used at Watergate. I mean, that's a pretty high standard, three independent
standards. It is a high standard. It's a very high standard. So when in the times, there are some times when I can't confirm something with three sources. And I'll either do one of two things. If I know the one source very well and trust that person, I'll go out with it even without the three. That's pretty rare that I'll do that. But usually if I only have one source or sometimes even just two, what I'll do is call it a rumor. I'll say, you know, I can't confirm that this is true and I can't get Microsoft to say it's true, but I'm going to call it a rumor because I believe there's some good basis for me reporting it. It seems credible and believable, but I can't confirm to you absolutely that it's true.
So if I see the term rumor in your column, that doesn't mean just J random rumor. It means a rumor that you find at least somewhat credible.
Yes. In fact, I started a mini feature on my blog last year that I actually should do another one of these. I call them not so crazy Microsoft rumors. So I explain at the start of those kind of things where I'll say, you know, I only have this from one source, but I have very good reason to believe it could be true. So I'm putting it out there for whatever it's worth.
That sounds like a great column. I look forward to that column. Let me ask you on a related topic. Do you keep a scorecard of the predictions and the denials and what turns out to be true and what turns out to be false?
I used to do that at the end of every year, kind of like a look back and here's what I predicted and here's what happened and here was my scorecard. But I haven't done that recently. And I try to be pretty upfront on my blog when I'm wrong. Like when I report something and it's really wrong, I'll come out and say, well, I was sure wrong about that one. You know, for example, I was almost 100% sure Microsoft wasn't going to do the deal with Nokia. I even said, I'll be really, really surprised if this happens. I think Nokia is going to go with Google. And so when it happened, I said, yep, I was wrong, way wrong. And they did it. You know, so I try to be very upfront with people and not pretend like I got it partially right or, you know, like I would have gotten it right except for blah. So, you know, I think that builds your credibility with your readers when they see you're not afraid to say, hey, I was wrong, and be upfront about when you're right, when you're wrong. I feel like I have a pretty good track record all in all with things, you know, tips I get that I report, and some people will say, that's crazy, that's never going to happen. Like an example of one of those recently was before Scott Guthrie was moved over to Azure, I had heard from a couple of my sources he was going to be put on Azure. And so I reported it and I said, I can't confirm this, but I think Guthrie's going to go to Azure. And I get so many emails from people going, you're off your rocker. You're crazy. That's so wrong. And then it happened a couple days later. So I said, well, I know it sounded crazy, but it happened.
Yeah. You almost got one from me saying, say it ain't so, Joe. But
I think it now seeing, you know, kind of seeing how they carved out the role for him, it makes more sense. And you can kind of feel why they did it and possibly, you know, what they're expecting from him there. But when people first heard it, they just were saying, you know, he's so tied to Silverlight and he's so tied to the engineering side of ASP.NET and this whole part of the business. There's no way that they're going to take him and put him on Azure. But what happened was they did, and he's taking a lot of those teams that he worked with in DevDiv over with him to the new role in Azure. So now it makes more sense.
And say a little bit more about how you see his role there.
Well, I think he's going to be doing is taking some of the teams he has worked with over in DevDiv, like the IIS team, the ASP.NET team, and a couple of the other ones that report to him now, and try to build those technologies and products into an app platform for Azure, and kind of adapt those technologies and make the developer story for Azure more concrete and apparent and clear. You know, a lot of my readers also think that part of the reason they are bringing Guthrie over to the Azure team is because, you know, he's kind of weighed in on what Microsoft's been doing around some of the open source technologies. And they think that Microsoft may want to make Azure more appealing than it is now to developers who tools. And they think he might be a good guy to kind of broker that tricky relationship too.
I'm sorry, you left me speechless. So
I might be way, way off on that.
Not because of anything you said, just because of there are so many things that I want to ask you. Let me take you in a slightly different direction and ask you about your own work. In the blog, you are amazingly prolific. I'm looking just at the last couple of pages, and there's 2-3 sometimes entries on a given day, and then a couple of days later, there's a couple more. Is this what you do full time? Is all of your research and work goes into the blog itself?
Not quite all of it goes into the blog. I'm actually a freelancer and I work for myself. I've been working for myself for close to 4 years now. But my biggest client of all my clients is ZDNet. So I spend most of my time reporting and writing for them. But I do some other things. I do other columns. I do some speaking engagements. I just got to speak at the Tech Ed conference on the Women in Tech panel, which was really interesting and cool. So I do a lot of other things too, but most of my daily work is around filling up my blog and trying to keep people up to date with all the different things across all the different Microsoft divisions that are happening.
Which must take a tremendous amount of effort to keep your eye on so many different parts of the business at once.
It's true. You know, the parts that I feel like I'm the weakest on, although I'm trying to kind of build up my expertise in these areas, are things that are more on the consumer side. So I'm thinking more like Xbox there. I don't write a whole lot about Xbox, although I've been writing some more lately about Xbox futures and IPTV futures and things like that, because of how focused Microsoft is on pushing this whole notion of the consumerization of IT and how business and consumer aren't really separate. They're intertwined. So I feel like I really need to beef that part of my coverage up more. But my blog at ZDNet is primarily supposed to help IT managers and be business focused. So that's why I don't write a lot about, say, gaming or Angry Birds on Windows Phone and things like that.
You described yourself as not a techie, but as a reporter. But you've been reporting in the technical area, if I have it right, for about 25 years. Mm-hmm. So how did that come about? How did that marriage between reportage and technical coverage come about?
Well, it came about totally by accident. When I got my journalism degree in 1983, I didn't have any specialty in particular. But I got my degree in Boston at Simmons College. And so I had just happened to be near the whole Route 128 tech hotbed. And I was looking for a job, and there were a number of reporting jobs starting to open up for people who could cover technology around the 128 corridor. That's when, you know, Prime and Data General and Digital were all really huge out there.
Yes.
So I applied for a job on a magazine called Electronic Business, which was a Connors publication. And I got a job there just as a entry-level reporter. And I told them, you know, I've never used a PC. In fact, the PC really hadn't been invented yet. And, you know, I don't really know about technology, but if you will let me learn on the job, I'm interested in seeing if I can do it. And they gave me a chance. And actually, it's kind of funny. One of my very first cover stories I wrote in 1984 was about Microsoft, when Microsoft was a very small company. And I got to interview Bill Gates and the whole board, and it was really interesting for me. And right then I knew I wanted to specialize in software because I thought that was the most interesting and up-and-coming part of the field. So ever since then, I've been covering software for a variety of publications and just got to learn more and more just by the various people I got access to and got to interview. And I found that the parts I was the most interested in were operating systems and tools. And so I really kind of focused in on those and tried to do a lot of reading and a lot of interviews around those topics to teach myself as much as I could about technology on the software side of the house.
Well, timing is everything. And I have to ask how interviewing Bill Gates went.
It was terrible. This was before, you know, a lot of people, especially a lot of younger people who asked me, oh, wow, you interviewed Bill Gates. I said, yep. And, you know, they know the Bill Gates of today. The Bill Gates of today is a very different guy than the Bill Gates of 1983 and 84 was. You know, today he's a very polished speaker, and he's gone through charm school, and he's a very interesting and articulate and friendly kind of a guy. In 1980s, he was very abrupt. You know, a lot of people who interviewed him at the time said he'd say to the questioner things like, that was the stupidest question I ever heard. He said that to me a few times. And you just had to not let it get to you. You know, I just kept saying to him, I remember, I'm new at this. I know I'm asking you stupid questions, but just try to answer them, okay? Because I'm trying to understand your business and trying to understand what you're telling me. So, yeah, I mean, I don't blame him for being short-tempered with me. I was just a kid out of school who didn't know anything about software, and I get to interview Bill Gates. But it wasn't a fun or a pleasant interview, and nor were any of the subsequent ones I had with him very fun or pleasant.
So you have yet to have your charm school interview with Bill Gates.
I do. I guess since I don't cover health and malaria and things of that nature, I may never get to interview him again.
Well, he's certainly a fascinating guy, and I'm hoping that you or some reporter will eventually write. My dream book is a paired biography of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs.
Oh, that's a great idea. I don't want to do it, but that's a great idea.
Yeah, we'll have to find the right reporter for that one.
Yeah, that would be an excellent book, actually.
You mentioned women in technology. Has that been an area of interest for you?
It's been a growing area of interest for me, for sure. Last year, I had a chance. I actually came up with this idea to write a series about women engineers who work at Microsoft. And I I almost never get to interview women in my job because a lot of times the approved spokespeople for the products and technologies I cover are men. And I realized in all the years I've been writing about Microsoft, I've probably interviewed at most 50 women total. So I went to Microsoft and said, you know, I have this idea to do this series about women engineers who work at Microsoft. And I want to do personality profiles of how they got into the business. And they let me talk to some really interesting people in all parts of the company. I talked to Xbox people, talked to somebody who worked on IIS, talked to someone who has been with the Exchange product since the beginning, the very beginning, talked to some women who work on Windows Server. So it was a really cool series. I did 10 profiles and got to talk to them about their whole career paths and how they came through the ranks and how they got the jobs they got. And I've spoken on a couple of women in tech panels in the past few years, too. And it's funny, you know, when they first asked me to speak on a women in tech panel at TechEd a few years ago, I said to them, oh, I don't think I'm the person you want. I'm not a woman in tech. And I remember I was talking to Eileen Brown, who used to work at Microsoft and who organized those panels. And she said, you're not a woman in tech. What do you think you are? And I said, well, I'm not a programmer and I don't have a computer science degree. And she said, well, a lot of women and men come to their jobs at Microsoft without having that background. And whether you want to know it or not, you're a woman in tech and you can help encourage other women to get in through kind of unconventional channels and different paths than they might think they can get in with. And so ever since then, I've been trying to be, you know, one of the champions and help encourage more women to get in the field, and especially more women to get in the field of technology journalism, because I feel like we're really a dwindling number now. When I first came to technology journalism, surprisingly, there were a lot of women in the field then, and there are a lot fewer, I feel like, now, especially ones who cover things like operating systems and tools and products. There, I feel like there are quite a few who cover general news and the stock market and strategy, but not that many who actually want to cover it at the product level. And I actually think this is one of the best jobs you can have. So I'm always trying to recruit more young and older women to come into the field and do what I do, because I think it's a blast.